And let's see if we can dispense with the calendar stuff quickly. AD and BCE in the scientific literature are equivalent. BCE means before the Common Era. But as a scientist, you're welcome to put AD or BCE. They do accept both. Now, BCE means before the Common Era. And then there's BP. BP is another term you're allowed to use. BP means before the present. So, for example, if you're trying to date a Neanderthal find, typically it's called BP, which means from the day that the publication was published, you go backward that many years, and that's when that bone was found. But before the Common Era would be like before Christ, and you count back that many years. That tells you you've got to knock off 2,000 years. Julian days are still used. They're used probably only by variable star astronomers, and they're called JD. And the reason why they prefer by what a Julian day is the number of days after God created Adam. And they use the Jewish system for dating when Adam was created. It's a little bit different than the typical Christian date for Adam. And then they count the number of days forward. And the reason why variable star astronomers like that is they don't have to worry about years. They just count the days. Because often a lot of the stars we're looking at have a variation period, say, of 881 days. So rather than making it 2 years or 3 years and so many days, they just say 881 days. So, for example, when I did variable star research as a teenager, I had to record all my observations as Julian days. And the other thing is you could record it as, back then it was like 2,700,000 and so many days, and you could put decimal points afterwards. That was the other thing. You weren't allowed to use hours or seconds. It had to be the decimal parts of a day. And that was a decimal parts of a solar day as opposed to a sidereal day. There's actually a difference there, too. Sometimes astronomers count their days differently than we count our days. The typical way of counting a day is a solar day, which is the amount of time it takes for the sun to reach the same position in the southern sky. But that's not the same as it is for the stars. For the stars, it's a little bit different. And so sidereal day is about 4 minutes shorter than a solar day because the sun actually moves a little bit relative to the stars as it goes around the 365-day period. And so those are all the days and calendars that are in use. And the whole point about getting away from AD is that if you're an atheist and don't want to say AD, they give you the right not to say AD. You can use things like BCE or BP as a substitute. So, but the Christians and all those who believe in God are still allowed to use AD and BC. That's not been declared illegal. You can do that. So I encourage you to use AD and BC. Yes. Well, that's the interesting thing. No matter where you go in the world, they use the Christian calendar. So everybody's using the Christian calendar. Yeah. So. Well, I mean, the original calendar of the early church was based on the foundation of the city of Rome, which was like 700 some odd BC. So they would start from there and go forward. But, you know, everybody agreed that starting from Christ was a better way to go. Pardon me? AD means Anno Domino, in the year of our Lord. BC is before Christ. So then BP is before the present. BCE, before the common era, or actually some have said before the Christian era. So that's the nice thing about BCE. You don't offend anybody. It works both ways. So, and then there's JD, which are Julian days, where you forget about the years and just count the days, forget about the hours and seconds and just count the parts of a day. Okay, I've been told it's been 3 weeks since I've done a scientific discovery, so I'm going to do a scientific discovery this week. And as I told you last week, what's typical is that the really earth-shattering or universe-shattering discoveries in science typically are made just before the end of the year, and this year was no different. The last 30 days have been phenomenal in terms of new discoveries. On the other hand, the really good ones are all a little tad technical. So if I get a little too technical in this, stop me and we'll move on. And we want to spend some time looking. Well, some of you were worried about my bringing the Quran to class today. We're going to do a comparative study between the Bible and the Quran and what it says about the foundations of the earth, that kind of being the leading statement that we see in Psalm 104. And Psalm 104, in my opinion, is the most extensive creation account in terms of scientific detail. So we're going to be spending probably a few weeks going through Psalm 104. May turn into more than a month. We'll see how it goes. But in terms of this discovery, let me start off with a question or a comment. It wasn't too long ago that the telescope on top of Mount Wilson here was the world's largest telescope, 100-inch telescope. And then, you know, by the 1940s, the 200-inch at Mount Palomar became the world's largest telescope. And for several decades, it was the world's largest telescope. But today, what would rank as the world's largest telescope? Anybody hazard a guess? What's the world's largest telescope? Okay, the Keck telescope is what? 400 inches across. And you say, well, maybe you want to look at the double Keck. And I think the two Keck telescopes, there are two 400-inch telescopes that are separated, I believe, by 1,000 feet. And so, and they try to do interferometry with the two and get a 1,000-foot baseline. Yes. In Central America? Okay, the Arecibo radio telescope, that's the one that was featured on, James Bond movie? 1,000 feet in diameter. And that's the world's largest single-dish telescope. But there's even a much larger telescope than that. Anyone? Okay. The world's largest telescope is the VLBA, the Very Large Baseline Array. And it measures a little more than 6,000 miles across. Okay, and I say, how do you pull that off? Well, it can only be done so far at radio wavelengths, and you made a comment, what about the space interferometer? There was a mission by NASA where they put up a satellite into outer space and linked it with a radio telescope on the Earth and created a baseline that was actually longer than the 6,000 miles. It was a little longer than, I think it was 14,000 miles long. However, it was kind of a test. It really didn't produce any measurable results that were of any value to astronomers. But it was a test to see that it could be done, because NASA has a grandiose idea of putting up an array of telescopes in outer space stretched over 50,000 miles in space and using that to image planets as small as the Earth orbiting other stars. And so they're asking for your generous tax dollars to make all that possible. But let me explain how this large telescope works that's already operational and what it's done to revolutionize the evidence for creation. Okay, the technique works like this. Right now. And with that clock that's 100 times better than the best clock we have, we can do interferometry in space at optical wavelengths. Because at optical wavelengths, you've got many more waves coming in a path than you do at radio wavelengths. Radio wavelengths is long wavelength radiation. Light is short wavelength radiation. And with the shorter wavelengths, it's necessary to have much better clocks. So far, this technique is only being exploited at radio wavelengths. But with the invention of this new clock, it'll be able to be done at optical wavelengths, providing you get above the atmosphere. And so that's kind of the mission that NASA has. They say we can use optical telescopes across, say, 50,000 to 100,000 miles in space, and we have these very good clocks on board, we can do this at optical wavelengths and actually image something as faint as a planet going around another star fairly distant from our star. And you say, well, how much of your tax dollars do they really need? a few hundred million would do it. This is really not that expensive of a project. Assuming they can achieve the necessary clock technology. Well, what has all this got to do with evidence for creation, evidence for the Christian faith? Well, when you look at the evidence for the Big Bang creation event and the creation history of the universe and ask yourself the question, what is the weakest link in creation science? You know, the science of trying to determine whether or not the universe was created by an entity beyond matter, energy, space, and time, and whether or not the history of the universe from the creation event forward matches what we see here in the Bible or not. It turns out that the weakest link in that whole attempt by astronomers to determine the physics of the creation event and the history of the creation of the universe forward is their capacity to measure distances. It's always been the limitation of astronomy. That's why when we teach a class for beginners on astronomy, the class begins with distance determination, because that's kind of the foundation for all of astronomical research. And to this day, that still ranks as the weakest pin in the whole creation theory, is trying to get better distances. And the problem with trying to get good distances is that they're all based on direct measurements of distance, and those direct measurements require high school geometry theorems. And if you remember, let me go to the blackboard again. The angles, if they have accurate measurements of those angles, tells them the distance to the star. Now, we do have a very accurate measurement of the baseline of the Earth's orbit. So you can use that, roughly 186 million miles. And if you know the angles accurately, you can get the distances. Now, the reason why this is the weak link of astronomy is that the stars are very distant, and that this technique can only get you direct distance measures out to maybe 100 or 200 light years. That's it. And you're trying to measure distances all the way back to the beginning of time, which means you want to be able to project this distance measuring technique out to 13 billion light years. Well, I mean, you can do the math. You take 13 billion light years and divide by 200 light years, you can see you've got a long ways to go. And so traditionally, astronomy has been based on trying to use indirect methods, which have a lot of assumptions built in, and trying to buttress all that. Well, what has come to the rescue in terms of strengthening the evidence for creation is a radio astronomy technique called the very long baseline array. Now, it's done at radio wavelengths, which means you've got a much longer wavelength, and that typically means you get less accuracy. The shorter the wavelength, the greater the precision of the telescope. But the radio astronomy community makes up for it by the length of the baseline. Now, instead of working with a 400-inch telescope, they're working with a telescope that's 6,000 miles in diameter. So they get the effective resolution of a 6,000-mile diameter telescope. And now, for the last, oh, say, 10 to 12 years, astronomers have improved these trigonometric parallax measurements based on the orbit of the Earth through what's called the Hipparchus satellite. You know, they always come up with these amazing acronyms. Hipparchus, of course, is a famous Greek astronomer and mathematician, but Hipparchus really is an acronym for High Precision Parallax Collecting Satellite. So, I mean, you can't have a project in astronomy until you get an acronym first. That's always the start of every major project. So Hipparchus, believe it or not, is an acronym. And with the Hipparchus satellite, which is basically a telescope on a satellite dedicated to making these kinds of measurements, they've been able to improve the accuracy by about a factor of 20 times over ground-based telescopes. So it's been a phenomenal advance, and has actually stretched our direct distance measurements out to about 1,200 light years. However, the VLBA has come along, and for the first time, just a month ago, they've been able to measure the distances to stars with 30 times the accuracy of Hipparchus. Believe it or not, they're getting down to about 50 micro arc seconds. And you say, well, what's a micro arc second? Well, you have 360 degrees, and there's, you know, a minute is, you know, 1 minute is 1/60th of a degree, and 1 second is 1/60th of a minute. So 1 arc second, and by the way, that's the typical resolving power of a ground-based telescope, is 1 arc second. And a Hipparchus satellite can get down to about 100 times more accurate than 1 arc second. But this VOBA can now measure the positions of stars to 1/10th of a milliarc second, or 100 microarc seconds, or actually some of the better ones are at 50 microarc seconds. So it's a phenomenal advance. Now, there's been one other thing. This paper just published 2 weeks ago, and actually a second paper came out yesterday. They've now been able to measure 4 stars with this technique. But what's especially significant is the kinds of stars they're measuring. Now, in terms of determining creation history, the history of the universe from the creation event to the present day has been fundamentally based on looking at the burning history of stars, or what's called stellar evolution. So, for example, when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto, we took this full year-long course, and all we did was study the evolution of stars. And, you know, the first time I walked in a church and started talking about stellar evolution, everybody in the church panicked. And I realized I can't use that word in a church, so now we would call it stellar burning history, which is really all we're talking about. You're determining the burning history of a star from the time it's formed till the time it burns out. And it's really not a whole lot different than, say, the burning history of a log burning on an open fire. And so sometimes I've joked with my boys that when we have an open fire, we're looking at the log evolution. So, but star evolution is the same thing as log evolution. You're just looking at how they start burning, how they continue burning, and what happens when they run out of fuel and they kind of burn off as a cinder. But that's been the traditional method for coming up with the most accurate age for the universe, is basing it on the burning history of stars. And what we notice, too, is that the universe, as it gets older and older, produces different kinds of stars with different kinds of burning history. And the real success of modern-day astronomy, say the last 30 years, is how astronomers have been able to perfectly match their observations of stars throughout the universe with the burning history of stars based on a Big Bang creation model. And so this is one of the stronger evidences in the opinions of astronomers that the universe indeed was created, and the universe has been evolving under a very precisely directed path from that creation event to the present day. In fact, it was stellar evolution that gave birth to what's called the anthropic principle, the concept that the universe was designed for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. So this is an example where evolution has given birth to very powerful evidence for a biblical creation scenario. But the weakest link in this whole burning history thing, I mean, when I was a graduate student again, it just blew me away how we could go on a computer and develop a theoretical model based on the physics of the Big Bang creation event and the laws of physics, and reproduce the burning history of a star that matched the observations to 4 places the decimal, literally for billions. I mean, it was incredible. And, you know, that's kind of what our professors are trying to show us. You just take this simple physics and you work with these formulae, and you can produce the observations or duplicate what you observe through the telescope with amazing precision. And that's because stars are such simple systems. You know, a star is nothing but gas from the atmosphere all the way down to the core, and you know, it's only based on a couple of elements, hydrogen and helium. Everything else adds up to less than a couple percent, and so with incredible precision and modern day physics, we can duplicate this. There is one place where we've not been successful, and that's newborn stars, or stars in the process of forming. When you go from a gas cloud and have the gas cloud collapse under gravity and strong magnetic fields and produce a star. That's the most poorly understood, and that's the one place in astronomy where we've not been able to get a perfect match to many places of the decimal between our theoretical models and what we actually observe in the sky. And so this has been picked up by a number of atheist astronomers saying, okay, maybe we have cause to doubt Big Bang creation cosmology. And, of course, young Earth creationists have jumped in and said, you know, maybe we don't have to adopt the idea that the universe is billions of years old. And part of the young Earth creationist model is that nothing happens after the sixth day. And so, for example, when I first ran into Dwayne Gish in 1980, he insisted as a biochemist that stars don't form. He says, all that happened on the fourth day. After the fourth day, no stars ever formed, and you astronomers are fooling the public when you say that you can actually demonstrate that stars are in the process of forming. So I tried to show him photographs, you know, look at these and see. But he didn't want to look at the photographs, and his whole point was, well, I don't have to look at the photographs because we know that the theoretical part of the model doesn't fit what we observe. And so what doesn't matter if you can see it, it's obviously going on. We do recognize that our theory is a bit incomplete. Well, it turns out that the limiting factor in building a detailed theoretical model of how stars form is our ability to determine distances to newborn stars. Now, the traditional optical methods don't work here because when you're looking at stars that are forming, you're looking at these giant gas clouds that are loaded with dust that are collapsing under gravity and complex magnetic fields and shrinking down to form a star. And the problem is you can't pinpoint the actual star that's being formed. And this method requires being able to pinpoint a particular source of light. And with the dust, often you can't see the light. Well, this is where radio astronomy comes to the rescue. Because of radio astronomy, you can cut through that fog and that cloud and actually look at the core that's forming a star. And what astronomers have been able to do to try to get the distances, they found a few of these newly forming stars, stars that are still in the incubator, so to speak, or in the womb, not yet into the true star stage yet. And they found some that have these large brown dwarfs, which are things, well, I mean, Jupiter is, about 0.1% the mass of our star, the Sun. If it were about 20 times that, we would call it a brown dwarf. And a brown dwarf will never become a star. On the other hand, a brown dwarf that's orbiting a newly forming star, as it interacts with the magnetic field, produces strong radio radiation. And so what astronomers are able to do at radio wavelengths is pinpoint the position by the radio emission of the core that's going to become a star, and they can also pinpoint the position of this brown dwarf that's orbiting around this newly forming mass that's going to become a star. Now, this is where they get the distances, because what you have here... Instead of using a baseline that's based on the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, you're using a baseline that's this brown dwarf going around this newly forming core. And what these astronomers did is they purposely picked these newly forming stars that have distantly orbiting brown dwarfs that are embedded in this gas with a strong magnetic field, which means you get a much bigger baseline than you get of the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, which makes the method more accurate. Then you're using this VLBA technique where you've got a 6,000-mile diameter telescope. And by that means, they're coming up with the most accurate positions ever determined to any kind of astronomical body. In fact, this is far superior to what they're able to do, say, with the Hipparchus satellite. And the real bonus is they're doing it on these newly formed stars. So this is going to be a huge breakthrough, and it's going to enable us to come up with very detailed models for how stars form, and we can take those models and compare them with the observations. And as one who believes in the Big Bang creation model, one who believes what the Bible says about creation and the history of the universe, I would predict that when we come up with these models, they will be a perfect match with the observations. And the rest of star formation history already is a perfect match. And the fact that it is a perfect match by itself is a powerful argument that the Big Bang creation model must be right. But you know the way it is. Opponents to Big Bang creation, namely the atheists and the young Earth creationists, will always go after the weakest link. You know, they'll ignore the strong evidence and go after the weak evidence. Well, in this case, we're going to see this weak evidence within the next year or two become very strong evidence in favor of the Big Bang creation model. But what's really exciting to astronomers about these papers is, for the first time, they're going to really understand the physics of how stars form. And the benefit for the astronomical community in terms of what NASA wants to do with planets, if we can understand in great detail how these gas clouds form stars, we're going to get a bonus because it will tell us how planets form. We know how the stars form, we're going to know how the planets form. And knowing how the planets form, in my opinion, is going to give us a whole new layer of evidences for the supernatural design of our solar system for the benefit of life. And as one thing we've learned about looking at the nearly 300 planets that have been discovered outside the solar system, they're all very different from the planets we see in our solar system. The exoplanets, none of them look anything like the planets we see. And the solar system appears indeed to be uniquely designed to make human life possible. Yes. While we already can go beyond the Big Bang in the sense that back in 1970, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose published a mathematical theorem which said that if the universe contains mass, and if the bodies in the universe, the stars and galaxies, obey the law, the equations of general relativity, then there must be a beginning to the universe. There must be a beginning of space and time that coincides with the beginning of matter and energy. And the causal agent responsible for bringing about this creation of space, time, matter, and energy must be an entity that did so beyond space, time, matter, and energy. You know, I referred to this in my books as the most theologically significant theorem of mathematics ever produced. And it's based on two assumptions. Does the universe contain mass? Nobody disputes that. But there was, for a couple of decades, strong dispute about general relativity reliably describing the dynamics of stars and galaxies. In fact, there are some atheist astronomers right now who are trying to claim that a modified Newtonian dynamics model would work just as well. On the other hand, the modified Newtonian dynamics models that are somewhat successful at describing the dynamics of the universe produce the same result as the space-time theorems of general relativity. They also require that there must be this agent beyond space and time that brings the universe into existence. In the latest edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I make the point that the only escape from these space-time theorems that point to this agent beyond space and time would be to presume that the universe at some point did not obey the second law of thermodynamics. But if that is the case, it would be a sterile universe. A universe that doesn't obey the second law of thermodynamics is a universe that's not able to support life. So the fact that we're here tells us that thermodynamics indeed rules. And in that case, there must be this entity beyond space and time. But you'll see in that book a quote I made from a paper produced by Ford and Roman, two theoretical physicists, who said all reasonable cosmic models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity, and therefore point to this causal agent beyond space and time. Yes. Well, what Ford and Roman did in their paper in the Physical Review was to actually take these space-time theorems beyond the classical context that Hawking and Penrose developed in 1970 and said, well, how would these conclusions be modified if we were to look at it in the context of a variety of inflationary hot Big Bang models rather than what's called the standard hot Big Bang creation model. And personally, I think inflation's right. But they showed that all the inflation models, at least those models that obey the second law of thermodynamics, also require this causal agent. And then the last half of their paper, they looked at all these quantum gravity models. The idea that quantum mechanics might behave in an unusual way before the Planck moment. Maybe you could get around the space-time theorems by speculating along those lines. But they said, you know, these quantum gravity models, if they obey the second law of thermodynamics, also are subject to the space-time theorems, which is why they concluded their paper. It doesn't matter whether it's quantum mechanics or some kind of inflation or some kind of other scalar field. It doesn't matter if dark energy is augmented by another factor that governs the expansion of the universe. As long as thermodynamics rules, you're not going to get around this beginning of space and time, the causal agent beyond space and time. Well, this all goes back to a paper published by a Russian astrophysicist who claimed that nothing is unstable. And so he says, in the beginning, there was nothing at all. No God, no physics, no space, no time, no matter and energy. But nothing bifurcated into anti-something and something. And so you take something and anti-something and you get nothing. That's what he says, nothing is unstable. And so he tried to go beyond that. This is Andre Linde, and he said, well, you know, maybe there was some kind of separation to something, and what came about was this space-time foam, where you got space and time fluctuating wildly, and one of those little nubs of space-time fluctuations somehow grows into the universe in which we see today. And this is kind of the basis of these multiverse theories. The idea that the beginning was just simply this infinite space-time foam, and most of the space-time fluctuations would be really tiny and produce nothing of any significance, but once in a while you get a space-time fluctuation that will bubble up into the universe we have today. And, there is a paper published in, a popular article, actually, in Sky and Telescope titled Bubble Land, and which the astronomer pointed out that this is simply pure speculation. There is nothing observable, nothing in the theory. In fact, it requires different laws of quantum mechanics than what we observe in the lab today. And in fact, all these ideas are trying to bypass the space-time theorem of general relativity and do require different physics from what we see. That's kind of the base of what Ford and Romine said. I mean, if you're going to go with the physics we see, the physics that allows light to happen, you really are stuck with the conclusions of the space-time theorems. But if you're willing to entertain that you can have negative energies and negative pressures, I mean, these are kind of wild ideas. Typically what we think about is if you take something and compress it, you're going to take more energy to compress it. But what if you're trying to compress some substance, and instead of taking more energy, you've got energy out of the system? I mean, that's what the second law of thermodynamics tells us, is that, you know, things tend towards decay, and everything works in a positive direction, but if you're willing to entertain negative energies and negative pressures, then you can really get some really strange results. But those are places where life wouldn't be possible. I mean, how can an organism function if you've got negative energies operating? That means every time you take a step, you'd be exploding. So, and, eating your food would be very dangerous. So, going to the bathroom could be explosive. So, and that's the whole point. I mean, you can't even, just cell physics wouldn't work if you were to entertain that the second law of thermodynamics wasn't operating. But there's still lots of physicists out there saying, we can build a model that doesn't require this being outside of space and time, but they also are quite quick to admit this is a model that does not pertain to physical reality. It's speculation. And Alan Guth, I think, said it best. He says, when we talk about building these kinds of theoretical models of the universe, it's not just speculation. He says it's speculation squared. And just one other comment about the multiverse. this idea of bubble land, where you have these quantum foams producing universes. If general relativity reliably describes the dynamics of the universe, what that theory of general relativity tells you, if you're in a particular universe with the capacity to observe properties in that universe, then already the space-time envelope of that universe cannot possibly overlap the space-time envelope of a second possibly existing universe. In other words, if God made 1,000 universes and only told us about the universe we're in, the limitations of space and time and general relativity forbid the human observer from ever discovering any details, any information about any other possibly existing universe, which is why we can't use physics to measure heaven. We can't use physics to determine the properties of hell. These all lie beyond the space-time envelope of our universe, and we're limited in terms of our scientific capacities to a small portion of that space-time envelope. That guarantees that any physicist who talks about universes beyond our own, it's based on speculation. There is no possibility, given that general relativity is a true theory, there is no possibility that you'd ever come up with observational evidence, which is why astronomers have pointed out a multiverse concept is an interesting idea, but it's totally untestable. And if it's not testable, then it really doesn't qualify as science. Now, there's a hand I saw back there. Yes. Well, general relativity will tell you that there must be some kind of agent that's responsible for creating matter, energy, space, and time. It doesn't give you any details about the personal attributes of that agent. If you want to get at the personal attributes, it's necessary to make other kinds of observations. And this is where the anthropic principle has come in. Let's look at the history of the universe from the creation event forward and see if we can see any design evidence, and let's see what that design evidence looks like, and by measuring that design evidence, we can determine the personal attributes of this agent beyond space and time. And that was kind of my goal in writing The Creator and the Cosmos, is to say, okay, what can we see from the history of the universe that we observe that allow us to make some deductions along those lines? And you can pick up about 5 different personal attributes of this agent beyond space and time, and therefore are justified in referring to this as a being, not just as an entity. Which is kind of the reason why I picked this discovery, because by being able to accurately determine these distances, we can come up with a much more detailed history of the universe from the creation event forward. And that more detailed history should produce more substantial evidences for design that will reveal even more details about the personal attributes of this being beyond space and time. So that's kind of the quest of astronomy, is to try to come up with this more detailed history. But what I'm picking out here is these two papers that go after the weakest link in this whole thing and say this weak link is now going to become our strongest link. I mean, that's a phenomenal thing. For 40 years, this has been the weakest link in creation history, cosmic creation history. And in the next year, probably, it's going to become the strongest link of all. So what was the weakest is now going to become the strongest. But what has really got astronomers excited, even those that don't believe in God, is that for the first time, we're going to really understand the physics of how stars are born, how planets are born, and after they're born, what happens to them, and how do they ever reach their stable conditions that we routinely observe through our telescopes. That's for sure going to happen. But also what's going to happen in terms of creation history, these 4 stars that have been measured so far are all in what's called the Hyades star cluster. And the secret to measuring the history of the universe from the creation event forward is to measure the burning history of clusters of stars. Now, the Hyades star cluster is the closest star cluster to planet Earth. And this is where this technique has been tested. And the Hyades star cluster is loaded with newborn stars. And so this technique works very well. But the Pleiades, that's a star cluster you can look at tonight. By the way, both the Hyades and Pleiades are in Taurus. And so the bright star Aldebaran in the middle of Taurus, that's right smack where the Hyades star cluster is. All those naked eye stars you see around Aldebaran, kind of the point of the nose of the bull of Taurus, that's the Hyades star cluster. And they're all newborn stars, or stars in the process of forming. But out beyond, you'll see this little saucepan-shaped thing called the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters. That's a slightly older star cluster. But there's still a few stars there where these radio astronomers think they can use this technique. And what the astronomy history, measuring as accurately as possible the distance to the Hyades star cluster and the Pleiades star cluster. Now we're going to be able to do that with 30 to 40 times more precision than we've done in the past. We're going to understand how these new stars formed. And already they've got four stars measured, and they're going to do a bunch more and move out to other clusters, because this technique can take you way out because of the precision. So this is exciting news. And within about 2 years, I should be able to report to you what this detailed history is. But I'm sticking my neck out and saying, this is going to be really good for what the Bible says about creation. In other words, I'm predicting that we're going to get this perfect match between the theory and the observations. It's a good bet because we're already getting a perfect fit for everything else. So I'm expecting that this, quote, weak link is also going to give us a perfect fit. But it's also going to make the rest of it much better, because it's going to improve by a factor of 20 times all the rest of creation history in terms of the details. Now, this particular part is going to give about a factor of a million improvement in terms of our understanding of the history of newborn stars. We can find we're going to expect a factor of a million improvement there, but in terms of the rest of history, all the way back to the beginning of the universe, we should get about a factor of 20 improvement there as well. So, now, nobody ever reported on this on TV or radio or in the newspapers. Astrophysical Journal was the only place that ever picked this up. But in terms of NASA and trying to fund this mission in outer space, I think they should jump on this, because this really shows you what this technique can do. So, but yeah, not a peep on the news wires, nothing. You heard it first here in the class. All right. First coming here, right? Okay. Well, hopefully that wasn't too technical for you. If it was, talk to me after class. All right. Psalm 104. Starting in verse 1, praise the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. And there are a couple of choruses that pick up on that first verse. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. Now that statement, you are clothed with splendor and majesty, is kind of a title for this whole psalm. Because what the psalm does is explicate the splendor and the majesty of the Creator in preparing the planet for us human beings, and preparing the universe and the earth. And it begins with the universe. Verse 2, he, referring to God, wraps himself in light as with a garment. We'll cross-reference this to show that what he's really talking about is how the beginning of the universe is we have this light coming through. Now, it allows us to correct some interpretations of Genesis 1. Where a lot of people think that the light came later. This is a reference to the light was right there in the beginning. He wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent and lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. This is poetry, so we're going to have to kind of go through this and see what all this is referring to. He set the earth on its foundations. It could never be moved. He covered it with the deep as with a garment. The water stood above the mountains. We'll get into that a little bit later. I just want to focus on these first five verses. Now, in terms of God stretching out the heavens like a tent, probably the best cross-references would be Isaiah 40 and 42. So let me just zip right over there. Here we go. Isaiah 42... Verse 5, this is what the God, the Lord, says. He who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and all that comes out of it, who gives breath to its people. Now, the verb here in Isaiah 42 is the same verb we see in Psalm 104. It's the Hebrew verb nata. But in this particular context, 42:5, it's in the active participle form, and actually could be translated, "He who created the heavens and is continually stretching them out." And you can see the consonance of Big Bang cosmology here. In fact, as I've mentioned before in the class, until the 20th century, the Bible is the only text that ever spoke of the continual expansion of the universe. Not until Albert Einstein came along did we ever see this in any book of science. It's alone here in the Bible. Also, the Bible is the only holy book. You won't see this in the Quran. I brought a Quran with me today. It says nothing about the stretching out of the heavens, even though it's in the Bible. And I think what's interesting about that is in the preface of this, it says, well, we do recognize that the Old and New Testament are inspired scripture, but there's really no need for the reader to bother looking at the Old and New Testament because all the important details out of the Old and New Testament are already included in the Quran. Probably one of the most outrageous statements I've heard from the Islamic community, the idea that the Quran includes all the important details, all the important information, and you really don't have to look beyond the Quran. And, anyone who's picked up the Quran, I read this when I was a teenager, and the thing that struck me is, number one, how incredibly repetitious it is. It'll pick up a particular sentence and it'll repeat it about a dozen times in the different chapters of the Quran. And then how little information exists in the Quran. It's one of the, well, of all the holy books I looked at when I was looking at the different religions of the world, this one has the least information content. Mainly a lot of statements about how great God is. And you say, well, I've heard that 1,000 times. Tell me something I don't know. And, then you get these details. We're going to kind of look at a few of these things, compare what it says here in the Bible with what it says here in the Quran. But one of the things it never talks about is the expansion of the universe. Likewise, you see the same claim made in Mormonism. They also accept that the Old and New Testament are inspired scripture. However, they say there's really no need for the Mormon to look at the Old and New Testament because all the important details have been picked up in their books. And they actually do admit that they copy quite a bit from the Bible. In fact, in the three Mormon holy books, the Pearl of Great Price, Doctrines and Covenants, and the Book of Mormon, they copy about 26,000 words verbatim out of the Old and New Testament. But they say what we do is we've taken the essentials of the Old and New Testament and we've updated them and upgraded them to a higher quality level. And indeed, you will find in the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham, both of those are in the Pearl of Great Price. Those are the only two books in the Pearl of Great Price. You'll see that Genesis 1, 2, and 3 are repeated, virtually verbatim, in both the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham. But in the chapters that surround it, they have creation content that contradicts what's in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. So, yeah, it's sort of the King James Bible. So, yeah, there's errors and all. That's true. They copied the mistakes too. So, but Isaiah 40. This is Isaiah 40, verse 22. Speaking about God who sits enthroned above the orb of the earth, which is a place some apologists have gone and said the Bible was declaring that the earth was spherical. Some places it's translated as circle. Shwug is the Hebrew word here, and could be translated either sphere or circle. But the whole point is if you're looking from above down on the earth, it's going to look like a circle. It's going to look like a disc. That's how it looks when you're looking at it from far away. You can see that through the NASA space shots of the planet Earth from space. That's how it looks. And only a sphere would appear to be a disc from all perspectives. But that's not the point I want to draw out here. The second part of verse 22. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. And so this is similar to what you see in Psalm 104, where He wraps himself in light with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent. And uses two different words here, uria and curtain, curtain and canopy, to describe how God is stretching out the heavens. So it's based on this Hebrew verb natam. By the way, it's in the same verb form in Psalm 104 as it is in Isaiah 42:5. It's in this active participle form, which means that God, on a continual, ongoing basis, is expanding or stretching out the heavens and stretches it out like one would stretch out a tent. And I say, what is this alluding to? Also stretching out a canopy. That's the word picture that's used in Isaiah 42. Well, the word picture here that both Isaiah and the psalmist is referring to is the habit of these Jewish herdsmen who would take their tent and fold it up and put it in the equivalent of a backpack or put it on top of a donkey. And then they would move their herds along, and when it came time to rest the herd for the night, they would take this tent out and they would expand it or stretch it out so that they could live in it. That's the phrase here. He stretches up the heavens like a tent. Or what you see in Isaiah 42, if I can flip back to there. Here we go. He created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth. Pardon me, Isaiah 40. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy. He spreads them out like a tent to live in. So it's the same word picture is being used here, that we can think of this squished up little canopy or tent, and then you stretch it out so that you can live in it. Well, likewise, astronomers now realize that the universe in which we live is just like a tent or a canopy, in the sense that the reality of a tent is not what's inside or outside, it's the surface of a tent. Now, we can live inside it, we can live outside of it, but the tent itself, the reality of the tent, is the skin that encloses this surface. So the surface of the tent is the reality of the tent. Likewise, we know that the universe in which we live is a surface. We live on the surface of the universe. We don't live inside the universe or outside the universe. We live on the surface. And if you want an analogy, it's similar to planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, and we live on the two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional Earth. Likewise, all the stars and galaxies, and even all the space-time dimensions are confined to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanded universe. Don't try to visualize it. It can't be done. So we live on a surface that is thickness. But hey, if it's a four-dimensional system, you can have a three-dimensional surface. Just like with the Earth, you've got three dimensions, but the surface in which we live has two dimensions in which we are all confined. So we're all confined to this. Now, again, this is unique to the Bible. The Bible is the only text previous to the 20th century that ever made this kind of a word picture for the cosmos in which we live. Yes. Yeah, well, the book I'm working on, the next book on Answers in Job, actually kind of goes into this whole debate. You like that one? Okay. Looks at this debate that's been raging for, ever since the German theologians launched their higher criticism theology. And they're the ones that made the point that the Genesis was really speaking about the sky being a vault and not being the kind of universe that we moderns think it is. And this was actually part of the thesis research by an astronomer slash theologian friend of mine, Robert Newman. And what he pointed out is that Job 37 actually explains the word picture of this vault and makes the point that, when these liberal scholars try to claim that the author Moses understood the sky to be a hard vault and was kind of borrowing the theology of the Babylonians, that there was this brass dome that kind of covered the sky, and there were little holes in the dome, which would let starlight come through. In fact, some of them thought there was just this divine light behind the dome, and the little holes were the stars. The stars weren't physical objects. They were just pricks in the dome, and the light came through. And other kinds of holes in it let the rain come through. You know, and that indeed is what the Akkadians and the Sumerians and the Babylonians believed. But, you know, I would agree with Robert Newman, you can't pin that on the Bible. And what he points out is that if you look at Job 37, it talks about this brass dome and doesn't use the word dome. It talks about a mirror and says, when you look up at the sky after the rain has fallen and the wind has blown, you can't look up at the sky because it will hurt your eyes. It's like looking at a brass mirror and having the light reflected off that brass mirror. And so what he's doing there is explaining the word. Oh, I'm out of time? Yeah, all right. Okay. Anyway, it's a good idea you're raising, and it is a major point of theological debate. Yeah, and it is just a word picture. So, but it's indicating that the universe, in some respects, is like a tent. And they say, you know, to what degree can we push the analogy? Well, it doesn't quite go all the way. By the way, no analogy is ever perfect. A tent has thickness. The surface of a tent is not a true surface, whereas the surface of the universe is indeed a true surface. So, in that sense, the analogy is limitations, as all word pictures do. Okay, we got to close. We'll pick this up next time. And hey, I really wanted to get into verse 2 and 5 and how it relates to this, because what the Bible does is accurately predict the details of plate tectonics, whereas the Quran directly contradicts it. So we'll get into that next time. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had in your word. Thank you for what a blessed year this has been. Father, I pray that you would bless 2008 in each of our lives, that 2008 would be a year in which we draw closer to you and learn more of the truth that you want us to discover and apply that truth in a way that we can more live out the character and the life of Christ within us. So guide us this day and throughout the rest of this year. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.